CKUW 95.9 FM, listener-driven radio in Winnipeg.
The following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular hosts will be back with a few new episodes of original programming.
Jesus just might live down in Fisher Bay, blending in amongst the boats and line. When it comes the winter, nobody seeks the Savior anyhow. He could just hide out past the broken hoops in that old Bible camp. A winding road will lead you to the mount. There's beer cans on the pulpit, clanking like a choir, diamond-covered baggies on the ground. Up there on Gospel First Nation, the highway feels like salvation. In days of childhood, wondered how I would wind up where I am today. Just need to see it for yourself. Does something for your health. If we left right now, I could show you. I swear Jesus just might live alone with all our sins in Fisher Bay, Manitoba. Sure sign of some sinner slapping things in park, leaving their communion scattered in the dark. You could sit for hours and only hear the sound of the trees keeping the lake and sky apart. Me and my old man would drive up to this place, talk about our lives and talk about the stakes. Often he would bring about the time his younger brother drowned, and he was thankful that he only lost his legs. Up there on Gospel First Nation, the highway feels like salvation. In days of childhood, wondered how I need to see it for yourself. Does something for your health. If left right now, I could show you. Oh, Jesus just might live alone with all our sins in Fisher Bay, Manitoba. Fisher Bay, Manitoba. I know my Savior lives peaceful in a house without any kids. Somewhere like Fisher Bay, Manitoba.
good morning, CKUW listeners. It's Marianne Sorelli, one of the co-hosts with Dialogues, Gravel Roads to City Lights. We are getting set for our episode today, which is going to feature two guests, Leah Gazan, the MP for Winnipeg Centre, and Jerry Tom. He's a councillor up in the Tuduli Lake area near Churchill, Manitoba. And we're going to be digging into issues surrounding First Nations communities prompted by the evacuation of some 4,000 people from Pimamichimac Cree Nation because of the downed hydro lines for 11 days that led to the homes being without power, and also the sewage treatment plant and the water plant being without power led to sewer backup and spills. So now the homes are uninhabitable. And it's raised a lot of issues in the minds of a lot of people about the lack of infrastructure maintenance and development in First Nations communities that's leading to ongoing evacuation, forced migration, homelessness in urban centers, as well as a lack of housing on First Nations communities. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. I'm going to be joined as well by Kaylin Spain, my co-host, who's in Arburg. He's going to be joining us later in the show. So with that introduction,
Good morning, CKUW listeners. You are listening to Dialogues, Gravel Roads to City Lights. And my name is Kaylin Spain. I'm joined by co-host Marianne Sorelli. And we have another amazing show planned for you today. We have two incredible guests who are with us today. We're going to be jumping into the topic is focusing around housing in urban and rural areas of Manitoba, primarily for our Indigenous neighbors and folks. As many of us are settlers on this land, it's important that we continue to learn about these issues and what's really going on in Indigenous communities, both urban and rurally, and to really get a deeper understanding of what folks are going through. And really, we see stuff in the news and that sort of thing, but our guests today are going to be giving us a deeper dive into how lack of housing, lack of services, and just sort of the really basic necessities of life are really impacting many of our Indigenous communities here in Manitoba. So we really hope this is an eye-opening episode for our listeners to learn, and to learn with us as well, as we all continue to learn how to be more informed settlers on this land. So I want to welcome both of our guests here. We have Leah Gazan and Jerry Tom. So welcome to you both. And I'll give brief intros for each of you and then ask you to kind of jump in with any details that you would like to fill in. So welcome, Leah. Leah Gazan has been a member of NDP Member of Parliament for Winnipeg Centre since 2019. And so many people are familiar with Leah's work, and her official title is the NDP critic for families, children, and social development, and also critic for women and gender equality, and critic for post-secondary education. Lots of work cut out for Leah in this role. And Gazan is a member of the Wood Mountain Lakota Nation, located in Saskatchewan, on Treaty 4 territory. Welcome, Leah, to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Did I miss anything that you would love to add for our listeners to know more about you?
No, that's okay. I'm sure we'll get into some really good discussions on the show.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Thanks so much for being here. And our next guest is someone who I've known for many, many years. He's like a brother to my dad, and I thought of him right away when Marianne were planning the show about housing and thinking about infrastructure for Indigenous communities. And welcome here, Jerry Tom.
Thank you. Yep.
I got a little bio for you here, and I want you to fill in some of the gaps as well, because it's actually, I've known you for so many years, Jerry, and you've just always been in our family and around, and Folk Fest, we're always, you know, calling out to each other. And so I just like see you a lot with my dad hanging out, and it's been lovely to like just like have you as like basically like a family member. And but then as we were preparing for the show, I realized like, okay, all these details about Jerry that I don't actually know when, so I feel like I know you and then I don't know you in so many ways. So I'm really looking forward to hearing more of your story today.
So
you were born in Churchill, but you like you kind of grew up. Can you tell us more a little bit about that? Like you grew up on Sayyasi Dene First Nation.
Let me explain who I am. So I was born and raised in Churchill, Manitoba. The Sayyasi Dene First Nation, our people were relocated in 1956 by the government of Canada. And that relocation created a lot of chaos for my community. We lost over 100 members during that 20-year stint in Churchill. And then due to the Indian Affairs schooling program, I left Churchill in 1972 to go to school in Dauphin, Manitoba. So I lived in Dauphin in settlers' homes for a couple of years. And then after that, I moved to Winnipeg in 1974. And I graduated from high school in 83, and I've been working ever since. So that's a nutshell my story.
Thank you, Jerry. just a glimpse as well as to like some of the things that we're going to be talking about today. And appreciate in your own words, your story. And so you were also like you returned to Sayyasi Dene last year as a band counselor. Can you tell us more a little bit about that and what that?
Yeah, last year there was an election happening in my community, and during that election, because we have a band custom election, I put my name forward to run as an off reserve counselor. And lo and behold, I got elected. I got 92 votes from the community members, which was the most votes for all of the elected individuals. And so upon my arrival here, my stint is a couple of weeks in Tuduli and then a couple of weeks in Winnipeg. So I go back and forth, and I try to be helpful to all the members when I'm here and do my best. And again, this area is new for me. Prior to my becoming an elected official, I worked for Manitoba Housing for 2.5 years as working with people in housing, with all the issues within housing. That was my role, to deal with all the conflict resolution, that kind of stuff. And then also prior to that, I was a student counselor with First Nations, with Keewatin Tribal Council and Iliwilik Tribal Council for 10 years.
So you've really seen like you're working back in your home community, but it's interesting that you say you're unfamiliar with that area, and it's but it sounds like you've got an important role that people voted you into that role. Well, I'd love to hear more about that too, as we can kind of learn more about like what that process is like and what that looks like.
Right.
Thank you, Jerry, so much, and it's really good to have you here. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
You are both really busy folks, and so we appreciate your time. And before we started the show today, we were chatting a little bit off air about politics, and Marianne was calling herself like a politician that's like just kind of recovering from that time of like listening to folks and listen, like really hearing for what people in your communities want. So we're gonna kind of get into some of our questions now around some of the issues that we're seeing right now. Really want to focus on what's sort of happening. Leah, I want to start with you around what's sort of happening we wanted to do this show. You did do a post recently on social media about what's happening in Pimichicamik. Oh my gosh.
Pimichicamik.
Thank you, Cree Nation. We wanted to make sure I got the name on air, and that's an otherwise known as Cross Lake, I think it's been referred to. And so, a lot of these communities that are being really impacted by kind of this failure of the system, right? Of the province providing just, you know, basic necessities. I'm wondering if you can kind of speak to that and kind of give our listeners a bit of an idea of like what you had to say about it recently.
Well, it's not just the province, actually. The federal government has a fiduciary or a constitutional duty of care in relation to Indigenous peoples in Canada. So it's overlapping a jurisdiction. And, you know, as I said to the minister, I was invited up to Pimichicamik to provide human rights and political oversight when the premier and the minister, federal minister, Rebecca Chartrand, came up. And, you know, it's important to recognize that, you know, this nation was left for 11 days in the middle of a power outage. And the results of that have been catastrophic. There's hundreds of houses that are beyond repair because of pipes freezing, sewage backup. And it's a normalized genocide of Indigenous peoples in this country, quite frankly. You know, and as I said to the federal bureaucrats that were there, this isn't a result of because we don't know what to do. In fact, funny enough, after meeting with Chief Munias and council members on that Saturday prior to leaving to Pimichicamik, I came home to find out I live in a condo. The water heater in the condo above me had burst and had flooded my condo. Can you believe it or not? Within 2 hours. Within 2 hours, all the baseboards were removed. I had several big fans in my house. The insurance agencies were in my place. The building management was dealing with it. I had the lights fixed to avoid things like electrical fires in my condo. 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 11 days, Pimichicamik was left, and it was a very willful breach of both the federal and provincial government's duty of care. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget that the chief and council have been very clear about the need to fix one of the transmission lines for a long time. They've provided a number of options, including clean energy options from hydro. We often talk about hydro being a clean energy, but it actually isn't, particularly for communities that are located around these hydro sites. This was a willful breach of their constitutional obligations to provide a duty of care. And what does it look like? This is the third time that Pimichicamik has been evacuated in a month. And where do they end up? They end up in Winnipeg Centre. Many of the evacuees, and I want to let you know, evacuees, as the representative, they are more than welcome in our community of Winnipeg Centre. I want to be really clear about that. Mm. But it also comes with a lot of danger. It's no secret that a lot of evacuees come to cities with predators and drug dealers waiting around these hotel rooms without security. Mm. You know, I've been pushing the federal government to ensure the duty of care not just happens in community, which they have completely failed on, but that duty of care follows evacuees. So we now see with the climate emergency, with a failure to provide, proper infrastructure in community, We are seeing indigenous peoples being, displaced from lands, thrown into urban centers without proper care, without long-term planning, because this is unfortunately becoming the new normal, and a failure of the federal government to act. And I just want to add that this is very serious, especially because the federal government passed a bill called Bill C-5 to fast track what they call projects of national interest. And basically it focuses around kind of 1950s resource extraction projects. And it was done without the free, prior and informed consent, for example, of modern treaty rights holders. It's in violation of Section 35 and Section 35.3 of the Constitution. And in Article 5 of the bill, Indigenous peoples are only one consideration the government may consider in deciding whether a project of national interest. This is a violation of our Constitution. This is in violation of free, prior and informed consent of Indigenous peoples, our rights to self-determination. So it's very, very serious. It's very serious. And what I've been pushing back on is housing, providing clean water. Is that of not national interest? Is that not a project of national interest? Ensuring that kids have proper schooling, is that not of national interest? Is ensuring evacuees are safe in urban centers, is that not of national interest? And I say, yes, it is.
Yes, for sure. Lila, you've laid out so many of the issues that we want to talk about in this programming. It's Marianne jumping in. And I want to follow up on what you're talking about in terms of the forced displacement, which, you know, in the introduction, Jerry talked about in his life experience of being moved from his home community, and that this is the same thing happening. You know, it's 2026 now. So we know that a lot of these evacuees end up spending years in hotels in Winnipeg after there's something like this happen. So I want to turn to Jerry. I don't know, Jerry, if you want to add anything from your experience of following up on what's happened in Pamikamak First Nation.
Well, I just want to follow up with regards to the comments earlier. We're having the same issues in Tuduli here. One of the things that I first experienced as a new counselor is that I have the policing portfolio. That's a public safety issue. We're in Canada, you know, in any communities across Manitoba, across Canada, we have police force, you know, in depending on number of people here. But on our First Nations, most of our First Nations have no police protection. We're lucky if we get a police constable that comes into the community once a month or every 6 weeks or whatever, but oftentimes that doesn't happen. And if they do, they come to give a subpoena to somebody, say you have to go to court. And that's the protection we're getting. Currently in my community, so you said that in First Nation, we are having what we call ambassadors in the community so they can provide protection for our people. One of the things that my community is experiencing with regards to what Leah said is that drug issues. We have a high percentage of drug concerns in the community, and that encompasses everything that we try and do as a chief and council. So that's one area that's a big concern, the policing. I went to Ottawa in October to speak with the public safety personnel, you know, from the upper echelons of government, and all I got was lip service, you know, talking about the, you know, where the government's failing. And again, that's what's happened there. The other issue within my community that's a big problem is water and sewer system. My community was first started in 1973, where the people came here And eventually we got some water and sewer infrastructure, and those systems are now antiquated. It's hard to get parts to get these things fixed. And because they're so antiquated, we can't make any new housing because we can't. Our systems are full here. And so we're at a standstill. We need housing. We need things happening here. But we're stuck between a rock and a hard place yet again. Those are the main issues here. And then if I can't build homes or I can't make plans in that area, my people are homeless. And it's just like one thing after another.
Yeah, that's really what we wanted to get into, is talking about all the things that are driving people from the land, from their home communities. And there's a lot of talk about reconciliation. To me, this idea that people can live in their home community in the north and have the infrastructure, the housing, the sewage treatment. Like when I heard that the sewage treatment plant in Pimimikamak First Nation had not been repaired and that it contributed to the sewage leak, I mean, that just infuriated me. The underservicing of these communities is really, like Leah said, you know, it's a fundamental violation of legislation, of human rights, all of that. But I want you each to be able to talk a little bit about what you're seeing in terms of this migration of people who are coming from their home communities to the city. And a lot of people, like even in, you know, my experience working with First Nations folks in Winnipeg, I used to work at West Central Winds Resource Center, and I've also more recently been doing some work in different communities in the north. Talk a little bit about this migration that's happening and how, you know, what's driving that? What's driving people still having to come to leave their communities? Go ahead, Leah.
Okay. Yeah. So basically, I mean, if you look at Pimbichigamak, it's housing that resulted from a failure to maintain infrastructure with Manitoba Hydro. Let's not forget Northern Manitoba is the cash cow for Manitoba. Manitoba Hydro is the cash cow, in fact, for Manitoba. And it's been on the backs, its profits have been on the backs of Indigenous communities up north, First Nations communities, who've had to deal with things like mercury poisoning in their water. I think of South Indian Lake, who had a nation that had 70% employment in the whitefish industry prior to hydroelectric development, mm-hmm. that now has 10% employment. So certainly the housing and the failure to maintain proper infrastructure. But if you saw this summer, wildfires that are being brought on by climate change, one of the things that Nikki Ashton pushed for or the climate emergency. But one of the things that Nikki Ashton pushed for in the last election is to deal with the winter roads because of the climate emergency. Even things like winter roads for more isolated communities are freezing to the point where supplies can get up. So it's the climate emergency. You know, if you ask the folks of Pimichigamak, that are staying in hotels right now as a result of a failure of Manitoba Hydro and the provincial and federal government to uphold their duty of care to Indigenous peoples and First Nations and for the people of Pimichigamak, they'll say, I want to go home. But there is no home to go to. They literally were in a housing crisis. It's what has happened as a result of this normalized violation of human rights is now they're in a housing catastrophe. They have their infrastructure, things like sewage, leakage. You know, not only are they dealing with the housing crisis, but because of a failure to even deal with proper sewage and water, in nations. We're on the verge of a major water catastrophe around Pimichickamack, a beautiful community, one of the biggest indigenous communities in Manitoba. So, I mean, the climate emergency impacts all of us. And then they come to urban centers, and then the federal government continues to fail on that duty of care. And then we end up with, instances of sex trafficking, a federal government, a former prime minister that likened the crisis of 2SMMIWG as an ongoing genocide and a failure to act. Can you imagine? They called it an ongoing genocide and they still failed to act. So this is a real crisis. And I think with the impacts of the climate emergency, it's only going to get worse.
Right.
I'd like to add to that, too, that when the First Nations members leave their home community and they move to the urban centers, the treaty doesn't follow them. Once they're in the urban center, they're on their own. And basically, the ban cannot help them because the ban doesn't have any extra resources for those members that are off reserve. And so they're stuck on their own to do however they're going to get by. And a lot of times, these individuals that move from their home community to the urban centers, they don't know how to get by because it's a new environment for them in terms of, even when the students go to school and they need to find housing, they don't know where to start. That's just one aspect in terms of the relocation and the issues that affect these individuals.
But so, Jerry, are you saying that the treaties don't apply even when they're an evacuee and they're in a hotel, like by the airport?
Okay, those ones are covered by their ban because they're actual band members living on the reserve, right?
Right.
What I'm talking about is when people actually decide to leave their home community on their own and they go to an urban center, they're totally isolated and on their own.
Right. And this is what I wanted to get at with both of you, to be able to talk about the contribution to homelessness in Winnipeg, like to make that connection with the dilapidated state of infrastructure causing these, sewage overflows and all these issues with mold in the housing, that how that's contributing to homelessness in Winnipeg, where the majority of people homeless in Winnipeg are Indigenous people.
So I just wanted to add, though, actually, under the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the rights of Indigenous peoples are portable, meaning that those basic human rights, whether you're living on reserve within an Indigenous territory or actually in an urban center, those rights are actually portable. In the last parliament, the federal government adopted a legislation bill, C-15, that affirmed the application of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples into Canadian law. And let's not forget the Constitution includes international law, but it also includes treaties and agreements. That's part of our constitution. So they actually are portable. But the problem is, it's one thing to pass legislation. It's another thing to break colonial patterns and colonial behavior. So actually, the fact that the duty of care is not being applied in Winnipeg is actually a breach of their constitutional obligations. And it's not just for Indigenous peoples. Let's be clear. If you look at fundamental human rights or Human Rights Convention, or even our Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and I know this is one area that you've been really clear about, Marianne, is people have a right, a charter right under Article 7, to live in dignity and security. So the fact that we are not providing housing that ensures the dignity and security of all peoples, including Indigenous peoples, is actually a violation of our charter. That's one of the reasons why I've been pushing for a guaranteed livable basic income, in addition to other supports meant to meet specific and special needs, including affordable housing, accessible housing with rent geared to income. This is a violation of our Canadian charter. And while while we normalize a violation of the charter, including the decampment strategy that's currently happening, which also is in violation of international law. The 72-hour, I'm calling them detention centers, jail cells, that's also in violation of international law and the charter. In fact, I don't even think it would pass a charter challenge. We're starting to normalize violating our charter with legislation that the federal government's passing, whether it's C5, C12, and all of these action we're seeing at all levels of government. As legislators, we are bound to uphold the rule of law, and that includes the Constitution, which includes our charter. So,
yes,
you know, the reason why we have a housing crisis is because of a willful violation of constitutional obligations and our charter, full stop. That's why we have a housing crisis.
Bringing up to the guaranteed livable income, and for people to start seeing that as a climate change policy because of all these disasters, fires, floods, you know, everything that's happening that is displacing people, and then they need to have some kind of guaranteed income. I mean, the income from their community would continue, but how many of those evacuees aren't working anymore? You know, that's part of the challenge. So
we are on employment income assistance, and then that money is limited, and then they may eventually find social housing. And so they're back in a square one in terms of my view, because if you're homeless in your home community and you want to get away and start anew and you go to the urban center, you're back in the same situation because of lack of funding, you know, lack of training as well. And we need to start working on those in terms of improving the lot of our people, because when I look at my home community, right now, I need people that are skilled in carpentry, that know how to fix furnaces, that know how to look after the water treatment plant. Like, those are important infrastructures that need to be worked on a regular basis. Right now, my community is spending probably $4,000 a month or more to have somebody from Thompson come in and look at our furnaces during Christmas while I'm in Winnipeg. We had major problems with their furnaces in our community, and I've had people, because I have the housing portfolio, calling me in Winnipeg saying, "Jerry, I need wood." You think about that. I'm sitting in Winnipeg, and my members are calling me individually saying, "I need wood to keep myself warm."
Wow.
So right now, in this new year, that's something I'm going to be looking into, because this is my first year as a counselor. My first year experiencing this, and I'm going to be quite honest, going, "What the hell?" That's my thought on that situation. Like, and so
you've brought up a good point, Jerry, and I think that's where, in the time we have left, maybe move to picking up on this idea that part of the solution is having First Nations people employed in things like carpentry and other areas services, so that there's employment locally, and that the work is being done that needs to be done without these huge external contracts. So that, part of what I did at Red River was teach community economic development, and doing that in First Nations communities. So talk a little bit more, we'll stick with Jerry and then we'll go to Leah. Talk about how you see the solutions in terms of moving away from some of the southern development models that have existed and are very difficult to kind of transplant in northern communities, and how First Nations can be self-determining and use a more sustainable and community economic development approach.
Well, one of the things that have been tried in the past is to bring instructors into the community, and then we go back to housing, shortage of housing. That creates a barrier in terms of where to house these individuals, that can provide training. Back in the day, I've heard that people from UCN used to come into Tidewell for training, but housing is the problem. And again, I'm stating that because right now, when I have contractors coming to the community to fix the furnaces, I got nowhere to place them, you know, when they're here for a few days or for a week. And so, but my thinking is that to train the people in the community is to have these experts, you know, within those fields come into the community, live in the community, get to know the community and work with the members. Right now, we have a solar energy project in our community that's been started about 6 years ago, and we've been working on that here to offset the diesel usage for hydro and for heating. And as a result of that, we trained some guys to look after that plant this past summer. We trained about 10 people, and the expertise came and did that work. So that's the way I can see that improving.
Oh, that's excellent. That, again, it's solar and getting off diesel. What about you, Leah? What do you see as the solutions to address all these complex, interconnected challenges we've been talking about?
Well, I think it starts with, so I actually did training in First Nations. I actually based my master's thesis around building capacity through training in First Nations. But it starts at like K-12. Let's not forget there's a lot of nations across this country that don't have proper schooling on First Nations. That's one of the reasons why the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal ruled in favor of Indigenous communities because of the willful and deliberate a violation of the rights of children on First Nations. So we need to make sure that kids actually have options. I was a vice principal in a Manitoba First Nations at the start of my career for a very brief time. My mother ended up getting sick, and so I ended up moving actually to Red River College. But one of the barriers we had is how can you teach a love of reading without a library? How can you get young people interested in science and technology if you don't have a science lab or proper Bunsen burners or sinks? So I think it starts early on ensuring that all children, no matter where they live, are provided with an equal education and equal educational opportunities in Canada. That still does not happen. But in terms of training models, in terms of local community, I believe in Jerry, what Jerry said, like I think it needs to be in person. Relationships as a lifelong educator are really important in teaching. You would know that Marianne as a teacher, I mean, mm-hmm. When I was teaching adult ed in a community, I was teaching adult upgrading. And if a student wasn't in class for whatever reasons, because it's hard to focus on school when you have housing issues, the school shutting down, you have water issues. There's all these issues that are common in First Nations in Manitoba surrounding basic dignity and safety. It's hard to focus on education. I'd actually drive to the person's house. Why aren't you in school today? What's going on? How can I help you? So relationships are really key. But also, I know that many institutions, for example, Red River College, are doing pilot programs in Indigenous communities where the training happens within the community. We certainly need people trained in the trades, but we also need to honor when we talk about education. I think we also have to look at it through a lens where not all education has to be based in careers that are outside of the ways that we traditionally survived, hunting, right, fishing, trapping. You know, these are all vital skills. And I say that because part of the issue when you look at all the resource extraction that is being pushed through these so-called projects of national interest, they're taking away the very essence of traditional life from nations. Those kind of careers need to be seen as equally valuable, equally celebrated, the same sort of prestige you would have, let's say, with an electrician and a plumber, a hunter and a fisher, and somebody who knows how to live off the land. In fact, if the world took the model of Indigenous peoples of sustainability and living off the land, we wouldn't be in the mess we're in. So I think there's a lot to learn from Indigenous communities rather than this 1950s archaic boom and bust resource economies that leave us poor in the end.
Thank you, Leah. I want to jump in here. It's Kaylin. And I work in agriculture, and I think it's just so important what you're saying around like valuing like these new kind of like careers or pathways that we're seeing for the youth, and especially for Indigenous youth in communities where like food sovereignty is really lacking. And like, as we've heard today from both of you, that you know, because of these challenges, because of all of these infrastructure and housing challenges, that like how are the youth, you know, supposed to go to school and focus? But like to really reimagine that, I went to Regina for the an Indigenous Ag Summit, it was called, which was bringing together communities from across the prairies primarily, and just hearing stories of what it looks like to sort of have like food, actually regain a sense of food sovereignty in a community where, you know, there needs to be empowerment of the youth. There was an incredible youth panel from Sioux, I think it was Sioux Valley, Dakota First Nation, that was had a youth committee that was then leading these various food projects, harvesting, as you're saying, Leah, like not just looking at kind of like farming and like this very settler lens, but I'm wondering like how, like if either of you have seen any of that in any communities or similar. I mean, for myself personally, I'm very passionate about food and how people, you know, return to the land and connect with the land. I do want to say too, like I think there is hope in a lot of ways in terms of like how bridges are being built, but that's kind of a different conversation. But I'm wondering if either of you could speak to any of like youth projects or that you've seen.
myself, being new here, I haven't seen very much in terms of the youth their activities, etc. But what I do know is that with the lack of infrastructure, even play structure for the little ones, there's basically nothing for the youth. And so if things don't improve, I'm not sure what's going to happen to the youth of my community. The school that we talked about here, my school in the community is like 30, almost 40 years old. It's falling apart. We have the kitchen shut down by the province because it's not good. We have mice in the school. The system, like the heating system, breaks down. We actually got no water in the school because of the system. And what I was told by the school the other day is that the teachers are boiling water and bringing it to the school so the kids can have water. So with that type of environment that we're dealing with, I don't know what's going to happen. It's really scary. It's really, really scary.
Yeah, thank you. And I know, Leah, you have to hop off right away.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask if you had any closing remarks and what you want folks to know.
Well, just one example, though, for the other one, there is a program called Land Guardians for Youth, and it's gone national, and it's working with youth to teach them how to live off the land. So just as a final comment, I think, you know, we're at a time globally where we see a complete turning a blind eye to human rights. And what I've always said is you can't pick and choose when you uphold human rights. Human rights are human rights. And when somebody's human rights are impacted, we all must be concerned. That goes for what's happening in Indigenous communities throughout the country, or even what's happening south of the border of Minnesota, or what's happening in Canada with bills like Bill C-12. where that violates charter rights, that violates international law for asylum seekers, migrants, and refugees, that I think it's an important time for all of us to get together to unequivocally say no to any sort of moving away from our constitution and the rule of law. And I think Pimicikamak is an example of when you fail to uphold the rule of law, people suffer and there's long-term consequences. So I'll leave it at that. I'm so sorry. I am very busy and I have another meeting I have to go to.
Of course. Thank you so much, Leah, though. We really appreciate your time today and for raising awareness of these issues and speaking to them today. Thank you so much.
Yes, nice thank you, Kaylin. Yeah, thank you, Kaylin, Jerry, and Marianne. Take care.
Okay, bye now.
Jerry gets the last word.
I just want to also reiterate what Leah just mentioned. First Nations in this country has been the most studied persons or people of this country. There's all kinds of reports and studies about First Nations. And, you know, somebody mentioned it's 2026, and we're still dealing with the same issues from the 50s, you know, and it's 60, 70 years later, and something's got to change, and our rights need to be recognized. Reconciliation that we talk about isn't happening as it should be, and we need to get more people on board to start working on these major issues, because from what I see at my community is struggling, and I'm doing my best to help my community, and I just have to keep doing what I'm doing to help. That's my stance with where things are at.
Yeah, well, you're already doing so much, Jerry, and it sounds like you're listening, which is a really big skill. I think it takes a lot to listen to the community members and to, you know, try to pass along their concerns. And but definitely, as we've talked about today, and as we've learned so much from this conversation, that there's just so many barriers and challenges that Indigenous communities are facing in Manitoba. And we do have, we have a long way to go, as you're saying, in terms of reconciliation. So really appreciate your time being with us today. And I wish you safe travels home, which I guess is a confusing term because
is home. I am at home.
Yeah, so you're home. And maybe I'll say back to Treaty One.
Yes, yes. Thank you very much. I appreciate being invited and nice to meet you, Marianne.
Yes.
I've heard your name. As soon as Kaylin called me, she said Marianne Sorelli. Say, yo, that former politician. Anyways, thank you.
The recording stopped. So I just want to comment on a couple things to follow up that, and then we can talk a little bit about our next show. So there is still a need for donations for Pimicikamak First Nation, which can be made at the Best Western on Wellington between Century and Keniston. So that's where you can take physical donations. The Red Cross is also accepting monetary donations. And, you know, the weather today is like minus 42 when I left the house. And people that are struggling to find shelter in this weather desperately need help too. So there's a whole list of organizations where you can make donations to help people that are unhoused. And I'm wondering, Kaylin, do you have anything that you wanted to say following that show before we talk a little bit about what we have in store for the next upcoming shows? Any events you want to talk about? Or
can you hear us, Kaylin?
Well, must be some technical problems with Kaylin's hearing the show, the audio. Kaylin is in Aarberg, and I know we've been talking to a couple of youth from rural and urban Manitoba. We're looking at having a show that's dedicated to youth guests and talking about what it's like to grow up in rural areas and then what it's like to grow up in urban and Winnipeg. And we're one of the topics that young person I was talking to brought up is the difference in rural and urban Manitoba in terms of consumerism. And there's a whole trend toward, you know, buy nothing or, you know, upcycling and recycling. And that a lot of young people are, that's one of the things that they're focusing on in terms of the way that they live their activism. And we're looking at maybe having a show talking about the difference in ways that people live that out in rural and urban areas. Kaylin's still not able to get in. So I just want to then thank the listeners again. We are heading into Fun Drive month in February. So this will be the first time that Kaylin and I with Dialogues Gravel Roads to City Lights are going to be doing a phone-in show of asking for appealing for donations to CKUW to keep community radio on the air. And we can look forward to that in the next month. And we're also grateful to Wooden Spoons, longtime show here on CKUW, for sharing this Friday morning 8 a.m. slot with us. And we can look forward to
the following
to,
is an encore presentation from
other
CKUW's
conversations
archives.
That we're planning. Lots more around agriculture, the issues that were raised today. I'm thinking of guests that can talk more about efforts to live off the land in rural and how that looks in urban Manitoba. We want to get into talking more about climate change and efforts to address all the various issues around climate change in rural and urban Manitoba. So get ready for Democracy Now, and thanks very much also to John volunteering here at CKUW providing our technical support.
Right. This has been Dialogues, Gravel Roads to City Lights on CKUW 95.9 FM, broadcasting from Winnipeg. Dialogues is broadcast Friday mornings from 8 to 9 a.m. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about today's program, please send your feedback or ideas for the show or leave us a voicemail on our office line at 204-786-9782. You can also follow us on Instagram at dialogues_mb. You can also listen to the recording of the show at ckw.ca. Please stay with us now. Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman is up next. Thanks so much for listening.
Some people think wetlands are wastelands. Actually, marshes and other wetlands are important ecosystems, home to an amazing diversity of wildlife. Without them, some species would disappear. We would suffer too, since wetlands help purify and control the levels of our water. Many of these fragile areas are being lost to development, so let's do what we can to protect wetlands. To learn more, visit hww.ca.